webcasting to the world.
Do you remember the moment you saw yourself and God and God and you, and you were one with the universe and God and everybody?
Knowing the truth about the gospel.
You were one with the prostitutes and pimps and priests and kings, and there was nobody on earth that was better than you nor less than you.
That we are all righteous.
And no one on earth was any less in Christ than anyone else.
That's Mike Williams, and this is the Gospel Revolution.
Welcome to the Gospel Revolution Powercast for the 7th of November 2013, coming to you from the Gospel Revolution Studios right here in Nashville, Tennessee. And from Houston, Texas, please welcome the founder and president of the Gospel Revolution, Mr. Michael Williams.
Good evening, Bearis Bartlett.
Good evening, Michael. The sun's shining. I mean, the sun is just going down.
It can be whatever we want.
isn't that the great thing about life? It can be whatever we want.
It can be whatever you want. Make your choices.
There you go. How's your week gone, mate?
One of the most wonderful things about the week is it's been fairly uneventful. Sometimes you need one of those, you know?
My grandfather, when I was a kid, running around their house, my grandfather used to say, "All I want is some peace and quiet. That's all I want."
Well, I've had what your grandfather wanted all of his time. You know, as I go about my day, people will ask me, you know, "Hi, how are you today?" Whether it's walking into the gym or, you know, grocery store. And I say, "Well, I'm wonderful." I said, "But I haven't asked anybody else's opinion yet."
Hey, I went to the gym this week, mate. I love the gym. They got a new machine down there for me, and it is superb. Mate, it's – no, you laugh, but it is fantastic.
What is it?
Well, I could only take about half an hour of it, and I started feeling sick. It's full of things like Kit Kats and Mars bars and gummy bears and potato chips and that, and it's a real workout.
Yeah, it sure would be. Especially to get it all in 30 minutes.
What are we going to talk about today, Mike?
Well, we were talking about this just before, and it was really funny because I want to talk about sin and you want to talk about grace. It's like, geez, we may have come up with a really good combination today. Well, during this week, one of the things that I've been thinking about is the issue of sin. And it just seems that it is such a major issue pertaining to the gospel. I just don't think that we could ever cover it enough in giving a gospel revolution view of it. One of my thoughts this week was about Bishop Spong.
Now, there's an interesting guy.
He's very interesting, a very intelligent, very senior fellow. I think he's in his mid-80s now. And very likable.
Anglican persuasion, isn't he?
I believe that's correct. Uh-huh. He's one of Henry VIII's boys, yeah. But I started thinking about – I saw the History Channel came on, and they're getting ready to do this new thing on the Bible. And this one very beautiful, obviously highly educated lady came on. She was talking about how – well, the verses that talked about Mary being a virgin. Well, this is just simply a mistranslation because it didn't mean virgin in the first place. So I guess that's what got me thinking about Bishop Spong.
So in most people's little square boxes, Bishop Spong would come out as a liberal, postmodern, Episcopalian theologian.
Yes. And over the years, I've watched the process of people out of religion into the gospel from whatever they might be coming from. And Bishop Spong has been like a sidestep for a handful. And when they've heard Bishop Spong, they've just simply made a hard right away. And literally, I mean, I've had this conversation several times, actually. More than I wish that I'd had to have had it. I, of course, am not concerned about the people, but the people who have listened to Bishop Spong, and I've had people who just have been just the, you know, horse out of the gate. Oh my God, this is great. You know, the gospel. And then they listen to Bishop Spong and they don't even want to talk to me anymore. I mean, it really is. And that really is a very accurate assessment So I had to get a little bit interested in the good bishop and listen a bit. I've sat here and I've listened to some of his stuff and watched it on TV and in different ways, YouTube and whatever. But if I were saying what Bishop Spong was defending, what he was promoting, I would say he's defending and promoting Christianity and tries to intellectually embrace the conflicts and contradictions there are with Christianity. There is a big difference between having a controversy with Christianity and trying to resolve those contradictions and letting the gospel resolve those contradictions. We have a lot of folks that are on different levels of sensitivity about the term Christianity, but I have no sensitivity to the term Christianity. Many of us try to listen for other people. I do that. You do that. All of us try to listen for other people and try to hear how they would hear it. But when the rubber meets the road, folks, I cannot ignore the history of Christianity. I cannot ignore nor defend what it is, what it stands for, what it promotes, and the impact that it has in people's lives. I can't deal with it in a way that's like, you know, we've got this almost nice thing here that's standing with us with a little bit of time and nurturing, it could change into something better.
It's like you can deal with the differences in doctrines, the wrinkles in philosophy that different denominations have, one with the other, but it's impossible to overlook the outcomes of Christian history, of the Christian religion. You cannot defend the habits, you cannot defend the practices of a religion that believes in beheading babies and that that's right, or that burning people alive is the acceptable way for the church to proceed. Slavery in the USA was supported by Baptist theology, amongst others, I might add, and it was supported that way for over 400 years. It was only 6 years ago that the Baptists actually publicly apologized for that. Murdering those who believe differently than you is unsupportable. Without the implicit, explicit, and complicit support of all Catholic and Protestant denominations in Germany, the Holocaust would never have happened. When resistance to violence is so rare as to be notable, something is badly wrong. When you say, oh, we have some peaceful people in Christianity, such as the Amish or the Quakers, well, yeah, really? What about the general population of Christianity? When you see rotten branches, there's one thing you know. There is a rotten root. You can take a dog and dress it up like a cat, but it'll never be a cat. Is that what
it's
you're saying?
It's still the same thing, yes.
So a pig in a fine frock is still a pig, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
It is what it is. Folks, you've got to understand that I believe Christianity to be very dangerous. Physically, it has terminated the lives of many people over the centuries, but it literally terminates life mentally and emotionally now for children. As I was listening to Bishop Spong, he actually made the statement that if Christianity does not drop the basic tenets of the faith, the virgin birth, the Jesus raising from the dead, any of the miraculous parts of it, that if they are not willing to drop these things, Christianity is doomed.
So what we are saying is that Bishop Spong is an agitator for change from within Christianity, without leaving Christianity.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
And what I have seen is that
a pig in a party dress is still a pig.
Exactly. And the people that I have witnessed taking in the good bishop's teachings leave the gospel.
Why?
Because they become impressed with these statements such as the mistranslation of this term virgin.
So you're saying it's because of his obvious intellect and his ability to communicate his beliefs. Is that what's...
Yes, and he points out the things about the Bible that are mistranslations, incorrect, which I don't have any qualms with that. I mean, goodness gracious, everybody knows that we go through this and we look at the things that are mistranslated. How many times have we done that? And we'll do it in the future.
But doesn't this describe a whole bunch of? I mean, if you talked about people like Ravi Zacharias, Chuck Missler, Dr. Kennedy, now deceased, Dr. Gene Scott, Josh McDowell, and other good thinkers, people who can really put their thoughts in very clearly and concisely, but aren't they doing the same thing, only they're pushing a different barrow?
Well, here's what it comes down to, and people in the Word of let me tell you who I would compare Bishop Spong with more than anyone. I would compare him with the Word of Faith movement.
Who in the Word of Faith movement?
All in the Word of Faith movement.
But we're talking about some pretty pretty.
The
brave.
Copelands, the Hagans, I would put him in the same category as them, because okay. here is the similarity. Here's the similarity between these two, but between Bishop Spong and his research, if you will, and the Word of Faith movement and their research. They're relying strictly on word definitions out of context. I did it myself. See, I'm not unfamiliar with Bishop Spong's technique. And do I know that it's powerful? Hey, it's powerful.
Can you give us an example?
Fairly wealthy doing the whole thing. So,
can you give us an example?
Well, just pulling a word out of context. Goodness gracious, any of them that you want. Goodness.
And then you build a theology on
build a theology on the definition of the word.
Okay.
So even with the terms about, one of our obsessions was casting out devils. So we took the terms pulling down strongholds and all of the terms that related to that, and we put them all in one basket, and we came up with a definition for these and came up with a doctrine based on a word definition. Now, I'm all about getting original text and looking and seeing what the word means. But you can't look at the word outside of the context.
In fact, the context invariably defines the word.
It absolutely.
For me, I know that the first place I go is Strong's. Mm-hmm. And then that's where I get a general, you know, a kind of a general feel for it. But Strong's doesn't get it right. Strong's, like the translators of the King James, mm-hmm. and many other Bibles, he translates words via his filters, his theological filters. And so the next place you've got to go is to the context, because when you look at how a word is used in context for, say, 40 or 50 examples of it, there's no mistranslating it then.
No. And so by wowing people with this, and this seems to be his, of everything that I've heard and people have brought back to me, and the reason they are completely leaving the gospel, I mean completely leaving the gospel or any persuasion about Christ whatsoever, the centerpiece for Bishop Spong has been his definition of the word virgin.
Where do these people go?
I don't know. I don't hear from them anymore. That's just it.
They don't become Episcopalians? They don't follow Spong?
No. I not that I know of whatsoever.
So what you're saying...
They could be now. They really could be, but I just don't know what that would be. But so, after hearing the gospel, in knowing and understanding the degree that the gospel reveals to you that Christianity itself is at fault, I don't know how that you listen to Bishop Spong and find out and try to go down that road and fully follow his line of thinking and the logic that he tries to apply based on translation of individual words with the understanding that people have gained about the gospel as compared to Christianity at that point. I don't know how they work through that.
It sounds to me as if Bishop Spong has the capacity to shake people from their present moorings without giving them new moorings. I might be wrong, and I don't want that to sound like a put-down, but it's what it's sounding like to me.
Well, no, and certainly I've been accused of that also, but I think while I listen to that accusation, even about the teachings that I do, I believe we do give people something drastically different. We even talk about the psychology of the gospel as opposed to the psychology that is developed under Christianity. There's a whole new way of thinking. So it's not like you're left out in the cold. This is a new way of thinking. But and we've covered this before. It's just this is what was going on with me this week in my peaceful place here in beautiful Houston, Texas.
That's right. We started off in your – okay.
And so I'm listening to this girl giving the very same thing. The History Channel is getting ready to do this thing on the Bible or Christ. I can't remember which one it was. But it's – I don't think it's aired yet, actually, so if anybody wants to tune into it. But she brought it up how that this word was simply mistranslated, and there is an element of truth in that.
Which word?
The word virgin.
I thought we were talking about sin.
Well, we're going to talk about sin, but it needed a virgin to get rid of to deal with sin. So.
Okay.
We're getting there, Bears. We're getting there.
Okay. I don't even want to touch the topic of virgins and sin. Don't want to go there.
Well, okay.
Make it fast, can we, mate?
We'll see what we can do with all of this. So the whole conclusion is this word was translated as the word. It really is the word made, and they are correct that this accurate translation would be young maid. But if you look at all of the places where the term maid is used in the Old Testament, it's talking about a virgin.
Well, there's another thing, too. If it meant maid, why would the Pharisees have said to Jesus, don't talk to us about our father. We know who our father is, but you haven't got a father. You're a, and essentially the word that they used was, you're a bastard. What right have you got to talk about fatherhood? But even more than that, it's very clear. All you've got to do is go to Google and type in etymology, E-T-Y-M-O-L-O-G-Y, and any other word you want. In this case, maid, maiden, or maidenhead. And you will see exactly the way the word maid was used right up to at least the 1600s. In fact, it always and only ever meant virgin. And the word maidenhead was the word for the hymen, the maiden's sign of her virginity that was usually broken and caused blood to flow on her first sexual experience. The very fact that people are saying that maid isn't virgin, all it does is magnifies their ignorance of the English language and its history. And just in case these good folks aren't yet convinced, remember back to your mother. What was the name that she had before she was married? It was her maiden name. Because the maiden name was the name that was associated with a woman when she was unmarried, untouched by a man, a virgin. These people are just oxygen thieves. In fact, people who make this statement are more than that. What they are trying to do is they're trying to manipulate and twist language to their own ends.
And then the very prophecy that they pull it out of, which it says, I, God, am going to do a very miraculous thing, and a maid will get pregnant and have a child. Well, you're going to have to figure out what's miraculous about a young girl, a young Jewish girl getting pregnant. And he said, and his name shall be called, I did it. What do you say, Michael? That's not what that says. Well, it is what it says too, because it says his name shall be called Emmanuel, God with us. So, God, how can you strip this word out of this? I guess what we're going through here is just an exercise in study. This is how I study, and I think the reason that I was able to identify Bishop Spong's folly, and I really do believe it is folly, is I was taught so well to take one term out of one verse and apply it universally to everything and come up with these doctrines, ignoring context altogether.
You know what I used to do? I made up confession sheets, and I'd take all of these verses, and I'd plug them all together and run them together. And, man, they said what I wanted them to say, you know what I mean?
Exactly what you wanted them to say, and no one could dispute it unless they looked at the guy pulling the strings behind the curtain, you know. So I'm well-versed in being verse-damned, definition, word definition and verse-damned. I'm telling you, Context. I know I've harped on it for the better part of 30 years. But if you don't know what you're reading, back up and start a little further back. If you don't know what you're reading, keep reading beyond where you are. And yes, glean everything you can from definition of words, but dear God, don't start a whole new religion based on a word definition.
Gospel Revolution.
If I am not mistaken, I believe that it was our cigar-smoking, bearded...
Saxophone-playing.
Saxophone-playing. Gene Scott.
Dr. Gene Scott. Now, there was a thinking man's thinking man, and one with a real doctorate, too, from Stanford University. Not one of these phony baloney doctorates like Creflo, Dr. Creflo Dollar. Jeez. But there was a guy who could make you haul up and think, wasn't it, Mike? He had probably the most convincing dissertation on the resurrection I have ever heard.
Yes, and he did provoke thought in me, and I believe that it was Gene Scott that first pointed out the difference between words. I did not know that the way a word is spelled in the Greek would define as to what part of speech it was. There are two words that is translated as the word sin, but they are defined by their spelling as a verb and a noun. Now, we all know that there's a difference between a verb and a noun. We could get really technical with this, but the fact of it is anybody that's gotten past the third grade knows the difference between a verb and a noun.
Well, I was always taught a noun is a being word and a verb is a doing word.
Yes. Huh. That's all there is to it. You passed the third grade, Barris.
Mm. Hang on. Wait till I pat myself here.
The two terms, the one that is the noun is hamartia, and the other one is hamartano. There's times when I'm reading, there's things that are so mistranslated based on the word itself and its context, it feels as though it was deliberately done. When we deal with the word world and we find four different Greek words for the word world and come up with this whole end time doctrine of the end of the world, when it has nothing to do with that at all, it feels to me like somebody deliberately mistranslated this.
Or even the other way around, five or six different original words that are all translated as hell.
Yes. So on and on we go.
It seems very self-serving, doesn't it?
It does. So I understand Bishop Spong's interest and his drive to point out these things that have been translated incorrectly. But as you have seen, if we go to these words and we rely strictly on the translation of the individual word without relying on the context, you see, what Bishop Spong does is cause people to totally doubt the context altogether. At the same time, trying to uphold Christianity. It's like, what is this monster that we have created that it even wants to stay alive if we dismantle any confidence that the Bible holds any truth in it whatsoever?
So what has all this got to do with sin?
The issue of sin has to be understood in context within the confines also of the definitions of the word. I began to look at how many times this showed up as a noun and how many times it showed up as a verb. The number of times was so overweighted that Romans was talking about the noun in this, that it was talking about the condition of sin, not the action of sin, that if you were going to go with the possibility of making a mistake, it would be much easier just to say that they were all nouns. You'd be less likely to make a mistake as to what you were actually reading if you just said that everything in the book of Romans is a noun. You're looking it up, aren't you?
I am. How did you know?
I saw that look in your eyes.
You sprung me. Well, the verb is used 6 times in Romans.
6 times, and how many times is sin used in the book of Romans altogether? About 30? 35?
Oh, man, I could count to six. I'm not sure about this. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I'm going to say at least 35, probably closer to 40. Oh, heck yeah. At least.
So you've got of the almost some 40 times that the word sin shows up here. Only six times is it talking about an action in the book of Romans.
This is the book where Paul says, so you're all sinners, and sin is this and sin is that, and where sin abounded, grace much more abounded. And, I mean, all he talks about is sin. It's like he really lusts after the stuff.
It's like he is obsessed with the subject of sin. And I wish that we, in understanding the gospel, could become as obsessed as Paul was with the word sin. Because until you understand Paul's understanding of sin, you'll never understand Paul's understanding of grace.
You mean to say, unless you understand how Paul understood the universality or the depth or the greatness or the breadth of sin, you won't understand that same measurement of grace. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. In fact, Paul's understanding of sin was something much broader than what has been translated through Christianity to the world to me. Because I will guarantee you, you mention the term sin to anybody on this planet of any religion, and the first thing that's going to pop to their mind is going to be an action or a deed.
Something they did wrong.
Something somebody did wrong.
Okay, you've got my interest. What did Paul mean?
When Paul mentioned the word sin in the book of Romans, Paul made it very clear as he began to compare the first and the last Adam, which is right here in the middle of the book of Romans, for him to do this comparison after we've, of course, don't mean to insult anyone's intelligence, we have, of course, have completed four chapters of Paul making it very clear as to what sin is. He's addressing Jews and Gentiles. And he's addressing both of their tendencies to leave the other out in this whole process. And he says, in one point, I think it's about chapter 2 or 3, he says, now, after he's done all the splaining he can splain, he says, and if you don't know what splaining means, then you just have to look it up in the Greek, I guess. When Paul's done all the splaining Paul can splain, he says, therefore, we have concluded both Jew and Gentile under sin. So all of this was to bring a conclusion about sin in its broadest context, that even people who weren't under the law, how can Paul's major address to the issue of sin to the people of Rome be their actions and deeds, when his number one point that he has made in the first three chapters is that even those that were not under the law were in sin the same way as those who were given the law? Yeah, this is Paul's perception and his conclusion about his understanding about sin, that sin did not come along when the law was given, that sin was already in the world, and it wasn't just in the Jews. A lot of people get this confused. I've had people approach me about that this salvation is only for the Jews, because if we are freed from the law, then Gentiles were never given the law, so therefore this is a Jewish salvation, and nobody else on the planet needed it. I've had that approach given to me many times, Barris. But that's where Paul's definition of sin is outside the law. Paul's definition of sin starts with the Garden of Eden. This is where we begin to understand this whole issue of sin, as he begins to tell how that by, in chapter 5, how he begins to tell us how that by the deeds of one man, all became sinners. Now, do you know Paul is the only one who explained this of the writers of the New Testament?
What do you reckon that is?
I reckon maybe he's the only one that understood. They never talked about this. They never spoke of this. They never brought up Adam. They in their writings.
Well, you're talking about people who, in their own writings, also said, "Look, we're not really interested in Gentiles. We're writing to the Jews." I think James and Peter both said, "We're writing to those of the dispersion, those who are Jewish." So, of course, they wouldn't mention anything about Gentiles. John seemed to be a little bit more open-minded, but didn't seem to mention it either.
Yes, and I think that for the disciples, this was really this was a Jewish thing for them, much more so than Paul. I just don't think that there was a point to where that they fully conceived the all-inclusiveness of the work of the cross for everyone inside and outside of the Jewish persuasion.
Well, hang on. Now, when Peter saw that sheet let down out of heaven, wasn't that a bit of a clue to them?
It was a clue. The interesting thing about it is that, see, when your mind is so set into something that sometimes even God can't break through. Now, let me tell you how this all came about. I challenge anybody to read that encounter that Peter had and to read what it is that Jesus said to him. And when instructed by Christ, this law keeper was told to rise and kill and eat. And he told Jesus no. I remember when I first saw that, Bears, it was a point that I just love to just kind of dig with. I said, you know, if you're that intent on keeping the law, you're most likely going to disobey Jesus.
Wow. Yeah, that's a good point. What happened next?
Well, what happened next is that after he declined Jesus' instruction to rise and kill and eat and told him, explain to Jesus why.
Jesus had to have it explained to him, I guess, didn't he? Silly Jesus. No wonder Peter made the first pope.
Yes, absolutely. So we find out that in Peter's encounter with Jesus after the resurrection, he defied Christ in support of keeping the law. Now, folks, if this doesn't give you a glimpse into the mentality that was there at the time, their claim was, we walked with him. We talked with him. That's why you should listen to us. They believed that he had rose from the dead. They all saw the empty tomb. But all of their contact with him was in when he was alive and also at his resurrection. They all were witnesses to this. But a mindset so strong that you would, in that man, Peter, would say to Jesus, I won't do what you say. Because I am going to keep the law. Now, I don't think that this ever changed, that mentality with the disciples all the way through.
But he then went back to the other disciples and he told them everything, exactly the way Jesus said it, didn't he?
Well, no, he didn't. It would have been nice if he did.
What did he tell them?
Well, Jesus said, do not call unclean that which I have already cleansed.
That which I have already cleansed. Sounds simple enough?
Simple enough. He goes running back to the disciples and tells about his miraculous encounter and explains to them that Jesus explained to him that even the Gentile can be saved.
Even though they're already cleansed.
Even though they're already cleansed, the only thing that he got out of it was they can be. So this has been the problem. This is Christianity 101. We have taken what the gospel says, which says that all have been cleansed, and we've translated it to the entire world. Everybody can be cleansed. Jesus said they'd all been cleansed. Peter translated that to all the disciples. Wow, I got a great revelation. This can even include the Gentiles. So everyone was brought down to a level that turned into Christianity.
So come to the Catholic Church, and now you can be saved if you're baptized as a child and you're introduced to the body of Christ. You can be saved if you keep all the rules and do all that stuff. And the Reformation comes along and Protestantism is born, in which we teach you can be saved if you just follow a different set of rules. But you can be saved. Not you are, not it, not you already been cleansed, but you can. In fact, we're still saying what Peter said when he ran back to the disciples and misquoted Jesus.
Every Protestant denomination that I know of is still carrying the message of Peter, the first Pope of the Catholic Church. And they've taken this message, and from what Jesus obviously said, we've already been cleansed, and now there's a possibility of it lost in translation.
I just love talking about that Peter episode, so I've taken you way off track, and you were, I think, telling us that Paul was the only one who carried this message of...
Yes.
Well, go back to there for us. I'm sorry I took you so far astray.
No, it's vitally important for us to understand that these guys did not see this eye to eye, that this was Paul. This was Paul's message. The rest of them never mentioned, not only Adam. It's been a couple of years ago. I went through and I should have made it public, but it was just for my own personal entertainment at the time. But I looked at all of the things that Paul brought up that the disciples never brought up. The parts of his teachings that are cornerstone to understanding anything about the gospel, and the disciples never brought it up even once. And also the things the disciples brought up that Paul never brought up. It's very ironic. I mean, when you start dealing with sin, there is no place. Here we have this iconic cornerstone of speaking of sin, that the way it is dealt with, the way it is dealt with is when you do it, you confess it. 1 John 1:9. Now, it is alarming. It is alarming that we take one verse in one letter of one of the disciples, and we build the entire understanding that we have of sin on one verse, and ignore virtually everything that Paul had to say about the subject. The one thing I can tell you is that Paul never taught people, even in dealing with the church at Corinth, as messed up as he agreed they were. He pointed out their faults, but never once did Paul tell them that part of the remedy, or included in the remedy at all, in rectifying these matters was that they had to confess their sins first. Not one time in Paul's teachings as compared. Everybody knows that Paul wrote the vast majority of the New Testament. The volume of work is far beyond what the disciples have contributed here. By volume, it's just it's minuscule. And yet we would turn to and look at one of these writers and totally dismiss Paul's understanding. Paul's understanding of sin was not that it's something you do. It was something that we were. And the remedy for sin, this is where
Say that again. Something we were.
Yes. Paul was persuaded that sin is something we were, not something we did. Now,
You just reminded me of a verse that says he was made sin for us, so he became something we were.
Yes. And that also is in Paul's teaching, that he was made sin that we might be made the righteousness of God. So on both counts, righteousness is not something you do now, and neither is sin something you do. Paul's definition of righteousness and sin both fell in the same category. These are not actions and deeds. These are conditions that we as the human race, that only one man could rectify for all.
These were both,
even as one man threw us all into the problem.
These were both states of being.
States of being.
Not doing at all. Okay.
Not doing.
Spread the religion of the rhythm of life.
When you're feeling down or you got the case of the blues, why don't you listen to the Gospel Revolution?
Of course, the whole issue here, which I'm just going to do this as just a little teaser for the folks that are coming to Canada. What this all leads back to is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And I'm going to commit myself here just so that I can't chicken out, is that our series in Canada is going to be on the subject of good and evil. We're going to go and look at the very roots of all of this and how it started. what had to be resolved at the cross. We've got to understand this, Barris, because if we don't, this gospel is lost. We've got too many very brilliant people out there trying to save Christianity while disposing of the gospel in the process. And, you know, some think I speak up too much about Christianity. I personally am persuaded I don't speak up enough about it. Jesus never invited anybody to come and be a Christian. There's no invitation except by King Agrippa, who said he almost became one. There's no invitation by Paul. There's no invitation by even any of the disciples.
No altar calls?
No altar calls to come and become a Christian.
A sawdust trail. They had a sawdust trail, right? No? No. Hang on. I got it. A solo sung soulfully just before an invitation. They had that, didn't they? Hang on. So, Finney, he had an anxious pew. Did they have an anxious pew?
I don't think they had a
well, where did the people who wanted to meet Jesus, where did they sit? They needed someone like Moody and Billy Graham to teach them how to do this properly. They needed a little bit of, you know, American get up and go, you know?
A little bit of sit here and wait your turn stuff, right?
Well, instead of that, what did Paul do? When Paul was talking to people about this, how did he encourage them to think differently?
Well, Paul's application of the term sin and using it incessantly as a noun, he was able to draw a comparison between first Adam and the last Adam. And it's only because the only way he can draw a parallel and a comparison between these two and call them the first and the last Adam is by virtually by the definition of the word sin being a noun. Without that, there is no comparison to the first Adam and the last Adam whatsoever.
Can you explain that?
Yes. Let me take you, Barris, to the point where that this all became an alarming comparison to me, an unacceptable comparison to me based on my Christian mindset. And that's Romans chapter 5, verse 14. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over them that had not sinned, after the similitude of Adam's transgression, which that's all great news. Who is the figure of him that was to come? What? Wait a minute. Stop everything. Every Christian doctrine that I was ever taught was brought into question in this one single line.
How?
Adam was a figure of Christ. All right, wait. Whoa. You're telling me that Adam is a perfect figure. The one who created the problem is a perfect figure of the one who solved the problem.
You know what that word is in Greek? When it says he was a figure, when you strike a coin, you use a die. It's called the die, and the die forms and forces that coin to bear the resemblance of the die. There is a die, and it's the die is, which is where we get the thing. The die is cast. Once a die is cast, you can't uncast it. So, Adam was a die. He was the molding agent, and Christ was the coin. Christ was the die cast.
Now, that blew my mind. This is the point where I went on tilt with this whole issue of comparing the first Adam to the last.
This is where you went postal on Christianity.
I don't know what happened. I just couldn't believe that Paul had the audacity to say that the perfect figure of Christ was Adam.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me, dude? What is wrong with you? What an absurd statement. Now, the absurdity with which, and the shocking absurdity that I viewed this with, is just how far off Christianity is from viewing sin through the right paradigm. If you cannot see Adam as a perfect figure of Christ, you will not be able to see Christ as the resolve for sin.
Wow.
This is so powerful. when we understand that this could not be changed, that the end result was sealed, just as sure as the die was cast. The die was cast in Adam as to how that this would be resolved in Christ.
Do you mean this was God's plan all along, Michael?
It was God's plan all along. This is the way it was supposed to turn out from Adam to us.
You mean we're living in God's plan A, not his plan B?
Yes, of course. And of course, this is from Adam after the fall.
So. Okay. Just for those of you who don't know, this is a private joke.
So the power of this is the die is cast. You cannot incorporate what the actions of Adam did. Well, you have to look at it clearly. That's why we're going to go into this whole thing of the partaking of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and everything when we do the sessions in January. Because unless we view that correctly, we're not going to come out with the die-cast review of this.
Hang on. When you go in January to Calgary, are you telling me you got some bombs to drop?
Yes. And, oh my goodness. In fact, should I tell everybody the title of the series I want to do?
Why don't you tell them next week? I mean, it's too good.
It's really a great title.
I'll go on. Tell them then. I can see the look on your face.
Title. Oh my gosh. The title for the series is Deliver Us from Evil. When we finish the sessions in Calgary, there will be people walking around on this planet with a 4 or 5 CD series entitled Deliver Us from Evil.
Oh, so you're only in it for the money, huh?
That's all.
Okay.
So by accepting this, this freaked me out. It angered me. I'm out here busting my chops trying to get people to accept Christ so that we can undo what this first man did. There's a culprit and there's a hero. And now you're telling me the culprit is the hero. So this blew my world apart. This one line at the bottom of this verse, that Adam is the figure of him that was to come. Oh my gosh. Well, we've got a lot to talk about this. I don't think we're going to get it all talked about today, do you?
I can't see that happening. maybe in 6 or 7 weeks. Hey, listen, I was just looking at that word again, that tupos, the die. And one of the other ways that word is used is, now that it's a die, it's not a copy, it's not the coin, it's the die, it's not what's stamped out, it's the stamper.
Uh-huh. Ah, good.
So one of the other words that, one of the other ways it's used is, it is a model for imitation. It's an imitatory model. It's the prototype. Adam was a prototype for Jesus.
Yes.
That is huge.
It is huge.
I mean, didn't Jesus have higher standards than that?
I know. And, of course, you can just imagine my word of faith. You know, I had it all figured out, Barris. I explained to people why my life was prosperous, why my life was good, healthy, because I had in front of me, and it goes around in front of me like a screen in front of me, a piece of paper. There's a line down the middle of this paper, and there's a line across the top. And above the line on the at the top, one says Jesus, and the other side says the devil. And I said, when you have the ability to put everything in your life under one of these two categories, you will then have the power to overcome. Now,
that's interesting.
It was also the greatest source to my ultimate downfall, because I really did apply that. And man, I remember it being driven into my brain that this was the dividing line. See, the power of comparisons is true, even if the comparisons are wrong. Something very powerful is going to come out of a comparison. But if you're comparing the wrong thing to the wrong thing, you're going to come up with something that could be very devastating for your own life and for others.
Is that why people say apples and oranges?
I think that's what they're trying to refer to. You've got to come up with the right comparisons. Now, I did not know that I was supposed to use Adam as a perfect image or figure, as the New Testament translated, that I should be able to, that I was supposed to be able to understand sin by understanding that Adam was a perfect figure of Christ. Now, I still read it, and it still is just when you're stuck in the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And I'm telling you, there's people that sit in this tree. There's people that the only thing they eat is from this tree.
Yeah, you're describing monkeys. Maybe yeah, I shouldn't say that.
A bunch of monkeys up a tree. I'm telling you, that's for sure.
And I tell you what, if you ever try taking their bananas away from them, you soon see what they are.
Yes, exactly. Believe me. And when you begin to realize that this tree that has been recreated, the tree that Jesus laid the axe to the root of, that the tree that has replaced this tree of the knowledge of good and evil is Christianity, you're not going to be so sensitive about saying there's something wrong with this, because there's more than something wrong with this. Christianity is the antithesis to the gospel. There is nothing that I know of on planet Earth that is a greater antithesis to the revelation and understanding of the gospel. Now, the thing that makes it so difficult is they use gospel terms. Christianity uses Bibles, and it makes it all seem right. But as you begin to understand what's actually taken place, you begin to realize, now, I've always said, and I will still say it, I can't judge people's hearts. I don't know if this was by intent or by default, but it does not lessen to any degree by determining by intent or by default that these things have taken place and these doctrines have come out of Christianity. It doesn't make them one iota less hazardous to the human race, mentally and emotionally and in every other way.
Part two coming up.
Boy, part two, I'm really looking forward to this. We're going to go through these verses. We want you to understand grace, but do you see that unless you understand sin, you will never understand grace? Grace will be something that you're trying to get. Grace will be something you're trying to walk in. Some grace will be something you're trying to grow in.
Well, in exactly the same way that Paul said, where sin abounded, grace abounded much more. He obviously presumed that before we even started to try and understand grace, we would have a full comprehension of what sin was.
Yes. In fact, he says, where sin abounded, grace did much more abound. I mean, he's very emphatic by inserting the word did.
Past tense. Thank you.
Yes. What grace, the way that sin abounded under the law, grace did much more. All of the abounding that grace needs to do has been done.
And so it is that we must leave you, folks. We love you, one and all, and we especially thank those who, with their financial support, keep this weekly PowerCast going out every week. If you'd like to join them in increasing our coverage of this gospel of grace and peace, call our office at area code 321-220-4373 and to speak to Jeffrey. If you would like to leave a message for the show, simply telephone me on area code 234-564-0971. Our web address is www.gospelrevolution.com, and we are always up for a Facebook chat at Friends of Mike Williams and the Gospel Revolution. Thanks to Marcel Roos in the Netherlands, all the gospel, all the time is being broadcast 24/7 at gospelrevolution.radiostream123.com. And so it is good night from myself, Beres Bartlett, from the Gospel Revolution Studios in Nashville, Tennessee.
And it's good night from Michael Williams on a beautiful sunny day in Houston, Texas, where it's in the mid-70s. There's a gentle breeze. There's not a cloud in the sky. I swear, I just don't know why everybody doesn't live here.
Yeah, you're a sick puppy. Remember to join us again next week, same time, same channel, where we're going to do the same thing all over again.
Oh, it's going to get so much better.
You bet.
Been gone to church since I was a boy. Now I'm old and I'm low on joy. I feel tired. Is there something I missed? Or is it just that I'm a Methodist? I got the Methodist blue. Sit in the sanctuary Sunday morn. Minister talks about a being reborn. I got a load of guilt that I've been carrying. I wonder if I should have been Unitarian. The organ is soupy, the pastor is bland. I leave afterward and I shake his hand. Sometimes I'd like to shake my fist. That's what it's like to be Methodist. I got the Methodist blues. Lot of odd people sitting in the pews want the sermon to reflect their views. Some of these Christians, they are the rudest. Maybe I ought to try being Buddhist. Ah, people gossip about who did what. The ladies' circle is a pain in the butt. I wanna slap their face or at least their wrist, but I can't, 'cause I am a Methodist. I got the Methodist blues. It's not easy being Methodist. Troubles, we got a whole long list. We're too rational, too Socratic. I wish we were charismatic. People always volunteer. Half of them old and the others just weird. I am blue and I'm getting more bluish. Maybe Jewish. Ah, everyone is afraid of change. Don't like anything new or strange. We get our underwear in a twist, and that's how it is with the Methodist. I got the Methodist blues. By John Wesley, not Chuck Berry or Elvis Presley. We're not so hip, but we persist. We go on being Methodist. We got the Methodist blues. When we die and go up in the air, St. Peter will hold out a diadem and say, shh, they're Baptists in there. They thought it would just be them. And if a Baptist you happen to meet, they may regard you as a foreigner. We got Catholics across the street and Muslims right around the corner. Oh, I got the Methodist blues. Oh, I got the Methodist blues.
Gospel Revolution.